Welcome to another episode of What Matters in North Carolina. As always, I am your host, Matt Calder. And first and foremost, I hope all of you listening out there had a very Merry Christmas and are looking forward to a Happy New Year. I know we at Freedom Action Network and What Matters in North Carolina certainly are, and we hope you and your family are as well. Now, if you're hearing this show, it is the special holiday show in a way, because during the week after Christmas until New Year's Day, us at the Freedom Action Network take the week off to be with our families, and that's a very nice, great thing we enjoy, but we still want to offer you a show and some content, whether you're listening terrestrially on the radio stations that we're on, or you're listening on the website, or you're listening through a podcasting app, however you're listening to the show, we still want you to have a show to listen to, even though we'll be out of the offices during that time. So, of course, this show is being recorded a little ahead of Christmas and will be set up all ready to go out to all of you at the appropriate time, whether you're listening again on the radio or you're going to catch it on Monday when it goes online. We want to make sure you have the show. So for this episode, we, of course, as you know, if you listen to the show, we're sponsored by the Civitas Institute. And the Civitas Institute has an annual conference, the Civitas Conservative Leadership Conference, that they do in Raleigh every year, or some years it's been in other places. But they have this conference every year where people gather from all over the state, usually people coming, but speakers gather from all over the country to meet and talk about different conservative ideals and different ways to be actionable in your conservatism, as opposed to just sitting at home maybe and thinking these things that a lot of people share opinions with you, but going out and doing something about it. And that's what the Civitas Conservative Leadership Conference is about. So what we're doing on the show today is we've got some interviews that I was out at the last CLC and collected some interviews, and we're going to play three of those interviews for you. The first two are congressmen from North Carolina. You've got Congressman Mark Meadows, who is of North Carolina's 11th congressional district, and Congressman Mark Walker of North Carolina's 6th congressional district. And we're going to play through those interviews. And again, so this was taken last summer or so. So this is a very topical interview still today, but you will hear some things in there that are probably make it fairly obvious it's not a brand new interview. But the point is that Representative Meadows and Representative Walker were speaking at the last CLC and will be at the CLCs and probably returning again. And then also we're going to have an interview with the keynote speaker from Civitas CLC last year, the Conservative Leadership Conference, 2017 conference, my mistake. And that was Nigel Farage. And Nigel Farage, if you've heard of him, then you may have just heard the name, but you probably know who he is by seeing if you see his face. But he was the leader of Brexit. You know, of course, the UK leaving the European Union. He's a British politician, broadcaster, political analyst, and he was also the leader of the UK Independence Party twice, from 2006 to 2009, and then again from 2010 to 2016. When Brexit got over the hump and the British government decided that they would indeed be leaving the European Union. And he was a staunch supporter of Trump during his campaign, which is where a lot of his more recent exposure has come from. But we have definitely a great interview with Nigel Farage that you will not want to miss. So, of course, I have to talk about subscribing to the show, because if you're not subscribed to the show, then you're missing out on the easiest way to get the show to your device. And to do that, all you have to do is go to where you will listen to podcasts. If you're an Apple user, go to Apple Podcasts. If you're an Android user, you just go and seek out one of the many podcasting apps available, and you can just go and search What Matters in North Carolina and subscribe to the show and get it to your device automatically. We also want you to go on Facebook and Twitter and follow along with the social media for the show. You can like our Facebook page and follow us on Twitter by searching What Matters in C. So it's What Matters in North Carolina to search for the podcast, and What Matters in C to follow us or like us on Facebook and Twitter. and you'll be able to keep up what's going on in the show outside of just the show. Now, we want to hear from you on social media, but we also want to hear from you literally. And to do that, all you need to do is call our call-in line. It's 919-747-8063. Again, that's 919-747-8063. You call, leave us a message, keep it clean and concise, a minute or two, something you want to talk about, or something you comment on a show segment that we did, or if you have an idea for a segment, you can do that there and you say, hey, this is Matt from Clayton, and this is what I think about that Nigel Farage interview. And if you do that and keep it clean and concise, we can play it on the air. But without any further ado, we will get to our segment with Representative Mark Walker, where he will discuss the GOP baseball shooting that you will remember from a few months back, and you definitely don't want to miss that. This is Matt Calder with the Freedom Action Network, and I'm across the table from Congressman Mark Walker. How are you doing, sir?
We're doing very well. It's always good to be home back in North Carolina.
I bet it is. I bet you don't get back here enough as much as you like, do you?
Well, with the family being here, we do make sure that we get back home on the weekends. We're in a very busy stretch right now in Washington, D.C., hopefully getting a lot of things done. In fact, I would add that the House has passed 158 bills this year. 37 of those have been signed into law by President Trump. Many of those had to do with rolling back the regulatory process. So that is actually the most. The 37 is the most in four or five different past administrations. So sometimes when you're hearing different negative impacts, negative stories about the president, know that he is working hard to get some things passed.
Right. I was going to ask if that's a better batting average than the last administration.
It is, by far. It actually had to go back to Ronald Reagan to find something with that kind of parallel.
All right. So I guess going with legislation, you've got a couple things in the hopper that are pretty big news over the past couple of weeks. So do you want to talk a little about the Bright Act?
Sure. We'll talk a little bit about the Bright Act. I'd like to talk a little bit about the VA, specifically also something that's not hit the presses yet is what we're calling our A-Plus Act. Very excited about that. That is going to be something. 2 years ago, you might remember that when the big education bill passed, we tried to get this added on as an amendment. Reached 194 votes, need 218, as you know, to pass the House. But specifically, these bills with the A-Plus Act in general is allowing the states to keep the federal funding, but reduce all federal mandates. In other words, each state and local community would decide their education decisions, not bureaucracies in Washington, D.C. So we're excited about several things this morning. And listen, we've been sent to Congress to be proactive. That's been our goal in the 2.5 years. A few other things that we're looking forward, but I'll give you an opportunity to ask any specific questions as well.
Right, and that's interesting what you talk about with the education bill, because that's a point of contention in a lot of different areas sometimes between the states and the federal government is, here's some money, here's some conditions. And there's that animosity in some ways, and that sounds like a way to kind of roll that back, at least in the education area.
Matt, you're exactly right. Conservatives, I believe, or should believe, that fundamental foundational piece of what we call federalism. How do we return as much power to the states and local communities as possible? To be consistent with that, I think it needs to start in education. I've always believed this, the more that you can localize government, the more effective it is. The higher you send it up the chain into the bureaucracies, then you have more hands into it. But when you have something like education, which has been a big debate for the last several decades, when you're able to return that power to the local communities, to the states, why is that important? Well, what it does, it gives you a chance for success, but it also separates the spotlights between how maybe California wants to do things versus North Carolina, how Chicago wants to do things, or San Francisco specifically. These local communities in these states should have the opportunities, and then you can see or have the results as far as what model, what has the most long-term success.
Right, and that's sort of the idea that the states are experimental grounds where you can try different things, see what works, and other states will adopt it, as opposed to this centralized idea of how things probably should go and then tying some conditions to it.
Exactly, and sometimes it exposes those who may not be necessarily doing a good job, but specifically in the areas of what philosophical approach is best to educate our children.
Right, and I also want to go back now to the Bright Act, increased sentencing on human trafficking, crimes.
Yes, thank you for reminding about that. Yeah, from day one, we were elected in the 114th Congress, started in 2015. the first new member to pass legislation, which was human trafficking. We believe that this is something that, not intentionally, but has crept up on us in the last couple of decades. Here in North Carolina, in fact, we're number 8th in the country now in human trafficking. That is something that should alarm us all. As far as how that has operated and how that has grown and expanded, the network, the criminal network. I was sitting down with a sheriff the other day, and in just basically two clicks on the web, there's a smorgasbord of very vulnerable people, and we're seeing that more and more take place. So we believe that mandatory sentences should be part of this for those who are involved specifically in smuggling or pursuing the predatory behavior. This needs to stop, and I believe this is something that we can win on. And I, you know, maybe bipartisanship is overused these days, but I can't imagine something that wouldn't bring us together as far as making sure that we're protecting our most vulnerable people in our society.
Right, and human trafficking is one of those invisible issues that people don't see. It's not on the street in broad daylight. It's a very unknown type of thing, out of sight, out of mind. So to say that North Carolina is number 8 in the nation is shocking to me, and I'm sure many of our listeners.
Well, yes, and one of the reasons you talk about it being invisible, it is because, first of all, you have to protect the victims. So you're not seeing that up front in person. Part of that is because of, hopefully, the improvement in their psychological, the physical abuse that they've gone on. You certainly don't want to expose them any more than already having to go through the court system does. So many times the Johns are the people that are involved in it, and the penalty phases, these people that are running these organizations have kind of gotten off a little bit scot-free here over the last few years, maybe a few slaps on the wrist. In other words, in the past, there has been a higher penalty transferring a pound of a kilo of drugs than a human being. And we would think, when we pause for a second, how is that even possible? Well, it's just a matter of the deviance of man's behavior and what's been going on, and our penalties and laws being able to catch up with that.
Right, and it's fundamentally shameful on a society to have that problem. So to step up and say, we need to put this out front, we need to take care of this, we need to have these mandatory sentencing laws, is really, it's shining a light on it, which, I mean, the Bright Act, if you want to take that correlation.
Sure, yes.
It's shining a light on an issue and saying, let's get this out front and handle it. It's just the way it comes off.
Well, that is the goal. You're exactly right, Matt. And we need more and more people talking about this issue, being involved. We've got some great nonprofits who work throughout the state that reach out specifically to our family. Very proud of my wife, who is a family nurse practitioner at Wake Forest Baptist Medical Center. She helped launch the Sexual Assault Nurse Examiner Program in the mid-90s. So this has been something that's catching up with our generation. I say our generation, those of us under 50 that are trying to pay attention to something that has grown up in our generation. And we need to put this in and eradicate this behavior. And I believe one of the ways that we can do that is make the penalties very stiff.
All right. And so let's move on a little bit to the Veterans Affairs legislation you're looking at. Can you tell us a little about that?
Sure. What we are trying to do is making sure that the VA is more accountable, whether it's protecting whistleblowers or whether it's reducing the wait time when it comes to veterans. And we saw 3 or 4 years ago, both in Arizona and some other places, just the tragedy of what the VA had turned into when it comes to putting people on waiting lists, falsifying how many people had been seen for bonuses. What this does is basically try to clean out the Veterans Administration in making sure that those who need this care the most are put at the front of the line while holding those in the VA accountable. Like many other bureaucracies or departments, the VA had gotten to a place where there wasn't a solid accountability structure. In the overwhelmingness of these bills this past week and a few more that we're trying to get done with what happened this week. We didn't get all the work done. But we're wanting to make sure that we are protecting the veterans, people who have served our country faithfully and dutifully, that they are certainly put at the front of the line.
All right. And I want to get sort of, I guess, to the elephant in the room in a way, and with the GOP baseball shooting, that you were, of course, there. And I want to kind of, a couple of days removed from it, see what's on your mind about it.
Yeah, let me do clarify one at this point. I've been the starting pitcher for the last 3 years, but was not present when the gunman started shooting. we discussed this Wednesday night at our team meeting. And I think one of the things that the guys are wrestling with right now is knowing that we were all part of an assassination plot that had been, we'd been cased for several weeks. I took a little heat Wednesday morning after I put out some information that this was a premeditated attack on Republican members of Congress. We're seeing more and more evidence that that was indeed true. In fact, it was released yesterday that he actually had a list of Republican members on his body when they went through all of his personal belongings. But he also talked with a couple of friends of mine, fellow members Jeff Duncan from South Carolina and Ron DeSantis from Florida, as they were leaving. Some of us sometimes will leave early if we have 8 o'clock meetings since we practice so early. And he was confirming that this was the Republican members of Congress. It is sad that we've reached a place where you have people that are so driven by some of the things that they're hearing, some of the things that they're seeing, that it impacts the nature to go to this level of violence. It's right on the right, wrong on the right, wrong on the left. But I think sometimes there is a certain level of hypocrisy that those of us on the right have to deal with when encountering this. For example, even over the last couple of days, I've seen the hashtag Hunt Republican Congressman, the Huffington Post writer from yesterday that talked about only shooting at one pro-life Republican is not enough. We need more organization when it comes to our violence. If these were Republican leaders or writers that were behaving in such a manner, it would be an uprising throughout the country. And it's unfortunate. We still have to maintain ourselves with a certain level of civility and statesmanship, but we do not need to surrender one iota on what we believe in the values that we hold.
Right. So, I mean, you're kind of saying that there's been in the social media sphere and this media sphere as well, this rhetoric and language that's made these types of ideas on the table for conversation before and after the attack.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if you look at the comedian that was made a bunch of news yesterday, holding up the head, the play in New York that was sponsored in part by the New York Times that had basically the killing of a look-alike type presidential Trump character. This kind of stuff is almost sport now. And there are people in our society that can't separate that. First of all, it's an incredibly poor taste to do it. We live in a country where you have such freedoms, but there are many in our society that when, as I saw a tweet yesterday that said Mark Walker is wanting to hurt children. Well, when you tweet stuff and when you put stuff out there, I believe there's a certain level of responsibility that comes with that opportunity or that freedom, I should say, because there are many people that are not able to process the difference. Now, he might have been referring because of our position on AHCA, which is skewed at best. There are people interpreting that, well, I'm going to do justice. I'm going to right this wrong because if this member of Congress or if this elected official is actually hurting children in his mind, he's believing that at face value, he's compelled to right this justice. And that's one of the reasons that you saw what we did yesterday, where a guy comes up with a Chinese version of an AK-47 looking to kill 15 to 20 members of Congress.
Right. And so how has that changed in this short term, short time since this happened? How has that changed your life?
Well, it's been very sobering. There were a few tears shed, and even at the ball game Thursday evening, I would be remiss if I didn't share that there are several members of my friends and colleagues on the other side of the aisle that have reached out. I felt like genuinely, but I'm hoping that it's a reset button on the rhetoric. One reporter asked me, does that mean you've changed your positions? Absolutely not. It's a time that it should embolden us on our positions, positions where we do advocate for the unborn child, positions of a strong defense, of limited government, but also one of personal and fiscal responsibility. That seems to be lost in our culture. I'm concerned, I'll put it this way, in my opinion, I feel like that we are getting to a place where, as Ben Sasse talks about, a generation of no scar tissue. It is those moments of adversity that allow us to build our integrity and build our character. And we've got to talk about these issues. Now, I will also say, as we've talked about Ronald Reagan, he was able to do so with a certain quality and a certain integrity. That's what we should aspire to. But we've got to call this stuff out for what it is. And to look the other way, especially in my position and the opportunity to serve in the United States Congress, to me would be an injustice.
This is Matt Calder with the Freedom Action Network, and I'm across the table from Congressman Mark Meadows.
And it's great to be with you, Matt, and certainly with the listeners, and look forward to answering some of your great questions.
Right, and we are out here at the Civitas Institute Conservative Leadership Conference here in Raleigh, and you've come off stage and close this out for this conference.
Well, it's an exciting time to be a conservative. Obviously, the left is really pushing back and trying to make sure that they keep control of Washington, D.C. But that's what the message was all about. It was really about the fact that we need to stay engaged, that we need to take action now and make sure that we return Washington, D.C. to its rightful owner. And that's we the people. And so as we look at that, I'm encouraged by the enthusiasm that not only I've seen over the last day and a half, but certainly the enthusiasm that is starting to rise up in defense of an administration who's wanting to really drain the swamp, as President Trump said. And we look forward to being a good partner with the people to make sure that that happens.
Right. And so it kind of seems like you've got some powerful friends, some backup now. And since you've come into Congress, you've been that guy. You've been, your leader of the Freedom Caucus. This has been your marching orders, your drumbeat for the entire time you've been there. And now it's coming into the mainstream.
Well, you're right. And, Matt, I mean, it's really starting to happen. I don't know how much power I have personally, but I can tell you that when I have the people behind me and that I'm willing to get in the foxhole with them, in the trenches with them, then indeed what we're seeing is results start to happen. And I can tell you, as the chairman of the Freedom Caucus and leading a group of members that are committed to the Constitution, committed to making sure that there's a more limited government and a power that rests and resides in the people of this great country, it is refreshing because now that is resonating not only on Capitol Hill and with the American people, but obviously at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. We're seeing actions come out of this administration that are really encouraging. We've just got to do a better job on Capitol Hill and not allow the excuses of the past to really be the destiny of the future.
Right. And so you're talking about, if you watch the news, they talk about the first 100 days of President Trump. They say, well, nothing happened. You did one thing. You're talking about actions coming from the White House. So that's not the take that a lot of people would have just looking at just the news or the mainstream news. And as Congressman Walker was saying, 27 bills have been already signed by President Trump.
In terms of repealing regulations. And so so when we look at repealing those regulations, that's all about putting people back to work. It's rolling back many of the regulations that came in just in the last few days of the Obama administration. But more importantly, I think this president will outwork members of Congress, and that's something that doesn't get told very often. I can tell you that I'll get a call from the president sometimes at 11 or 12 o'clock at night, and then can get a follow-up call the next morning at 6 or 6:30. It's interesting to see a president that is working around the clock like he is. I don't know when he sleeps. I get worried that he's just so unbelievably active trying to keep things rolling. There's a frustration. I think you heard it with some of the people that have attended this leadership conference, that there's a frustration. Why can't we get more done? Why are we not making greater progress? And I think that's why they shouldn't be willing to take excuses, whether it be from Democrat or Republican members of Congress.
So it sounds like you got a commander in chief, he's really dogging you guys to
he is. I mean, he's saying get, and in fact, they don't understand what the holdup is. Now, part of that is a business guy that comes to Washington, D.C. He expects to get results. As a business guy myself that believes that you know, results are the only thing that matter. Effort, you don't get paid for effort in Washington, D.C., and yet they seem to applaud effort more than they do results. It is critically important that we move on and make sure that the president's agenda gets accomplished. You know, was mentioned in the conference about the war room in Steve Bannon's office where all the campaign promises are put up on the wall. And indeed, that has happened. I've been in that room a number of times. And they're checking off. This campaign promise was made. This one is accomplished. So he's serious about fulfilling every one of those. That doesn't get reported a whole lot, but he is dead serious about making sure that he follows through on everything.
Right. And I mean, just going back to that, it's really he seems to have a lot of enemies around, or people who definitely aren't friendly to what he's doing. But as far as, and that's in Congress as well. But as far as you and he, it's like you're the, not, I don't know about the original necessarily, but you were there already doing these things, and you weren't the most popular guy in a lot of ways.
I told him that. I told the president that. I said, Mr. President, let me just tell you, when you do the right thing, you're not going to get the applause of people, certainly not in this town, meaning Washington, D.C. But when you do the right thing, you do get the applause of the people back home. And so for me, it's all about the people I represent in North Carolina. And getting that applause of the people that I represent is far more important than getting the applause of special interests on K Street. But I can tell you that it is vicious, and really our president is reaping just the whole mentality of Washington, D.C., and the bureaucracy that fights back against him, some within his own party fighting against him. And ultimately, we've got to make sure that we allow his agenda to move forward, and because his agenda is really the people's agenda.
Right. And one thing I really liked that you said was talking about a results-driven value versus – an effort value. I mean, if you talk about just in the state legislatures, national, you know, in Congress, there's this, you know, people who are filing bills they know are never going to go anywhere, a message bill, or it's a fundraising bill. It's I filed this bill to do away with this. I knew it was going to go nowhere. I didn't even really run it.
Right.
But I'm going to use it for fundraising.
Well, Matt, you know the hidden secret that's out there, and that's probably the thing that as a member of Congress I've been more frustrated about than anything. Some people who will campaign as if everything is okay and it's all going to work out, and they file this bill and say, well, look, I am touting this bill, but they really don't want that bill to come up for a vote. Or they think that it won't come up for a vote. It's time to be serious about the people's business and let the actions and results speak for themselves, and quit with this fake mirage that goes on. You know, the smoke and mirrors that says I'm really here when I'm actually over here on the left. And we're all about holding accountable. That's what the Freedom Caucus is all about. I can tell you, we believe that we're representing the forgotten man or woman. The forgotten man or woman on Main Street or Maple Street or Elm Street or whatever street you happen to live on in the United States. And the fact that they look at it and they see the mainstream media and all the things that are going on, and they said, yeah, but what about me? What about my priorities? Those are not my priorities. We believe that we've got to be a voice for the millions of Americans who think that Washington, D.C. has forgotten them. And so sometimes that puts us at odds with the powers in Washington, D.C.
Right. So what's next for the Freedom Caucus?
You know, I think there's two things. One is we're going to continue to work very closely. We believe that there needs to be welfare reform. One of the pushes that we're really touting right now is to say that there should be a work requirement for able-bodied single adults. And if we don't mind providing a safety net, but if you're able-bodied and you can work, then you should be working. And so we're going to be pushing for that. Tax reform, we're looking at really looking at lowering corporate taxes right away. And again, getting all of that finished before the end of July. And then the last thing is, if we don't get it finished by the end of July, we need to cancel the August recess and work. and make sure that we get it done. And that's not to say that we don't work when we come back home to our districts, but there's only one place that legislation can get done. That's in Washington, D.C. And if we have not sent substantial pieces of legislation to the president, we need to stay until it gets done.
All right. And I have one final question I want to ask you about. So obviously in the news this week was the GOP baseball shooting. And,
right.
And while it was an attack on, you know, the people who were there, really it was an attack on all Republican legislators in Washington.
Right.
There was no set list of who would be there. It was an attack on you. It was an attack on your fellow Republicans.
Right.
So how does that hit you?
Well, I mean, obviously we're not promised tomorrow, Matt. And I think that for your listeners, they know, I mean, that we have a target on, you know, maybe our back or our chest for serving. But here's what I do. We have a great country. We have a great God. But we also have men and women who serve in the military each and every day and put their lives on the lines in ways that I have never put my life on the line in a similar way. We have law enforcement, first responders that are missing birthdays, anniversaries, and everything else to serve their public and actually putting their lives on the line. And so does it have an effect? Sure, we've got to be more vigilant. But you put it in relative terms, it makes me be more thankful of our law enforcement, our military men and women, our first responders. So I have made sure that each and every person I see that serves in that capacity gets my thank you. And so my ask of your listeners would do the same thing. Don't think about members of Congress and what we may face, but think about what makes this country great. You know, there's crosses and Star of David's on a hill over in Normandy for the greatest generation who fought for liberty and freedom on those shores. It's a reminder that some pay the ultimate sacrifice.
All right, this is Matt Calder with the Freedom Action Network, and I'm sitting across the table from Nigel Farage, the face of Brexit, and I'm really pleased to have you here today.
I'm pleased to be here. Big messages. You know, Brexit was a big message. The election of Trump was a big message. We're now nearly a year down the line from some of those events happening, and it's a good opportunity to kind of take stock of just how significant those victories were, but equally how hard the establishment are fighting back to try and thwart us.
Right, and that's exactly what I want to talk to you about today. So on your side, on the Brexit side, it looks like there's a real push and possibility that there may be another referendum, there'll be some pushback, some weakening of Brexit, which, I mean, you came into politics for Brexit.
Mm-hmm.
You left when Brexit was achieved. So what does that mean for you?
Well, I didn't leave completely. I ceased to be the leader of a national UK political party, but I did continue to be a group leader in the European Parliament, and I will see that through. And of course, it's worth remembering that the Brexit negotiations will take place in Brussels. So I saw that as being my natural place for the next 2 years to see the process through. What I couldn't possibly have foreseen was the sheer idiocy of a Prime Minister calling an unnecessary general election and reopening the debate that we'd sorted out a year ago. And of course, it's funny, isn't it? You open a debate on one subject, but because of events, it finishes up on polling day being about not just that, but many other subjects. So yeah, you know, I mean, do I think that Brexit will happen? Yes, of course it will. It's impossible that it can't. I mean, now, 70% of the British public, whichever way they voted, think Brexit should happen, and the government's job is to get on with it. The concern is that what the general election did last week is it handed considerable power back to the political class. And the instincts of the political class, of course, are for big, taxpayer-funded forms of multilateral government based in Brussels. So, and by the way, if you think I'm being cynical, I've been there for 18 years. I know how this works. So there is a problem here now that we do potentially face backsliding, I think is the word that we would use on this. Mm-hmm. And that we might find ourselves having in 2 years' time, let's say, having left the European Union, but perhaps having left it in name only, and finding that our sovereignty and our control of our borders and many of these things are still very seriously compromised. So I'm, from my own perspective, I'm looking on at all of this. I haven't decided what to do yet. Is it the right moment for me now to step back into the field in UK politics? Would it be wiser for me to wait to see whether perhaps my fears aren't confirmed? So I'm at the moment in a period of reflection about the general election. But all I would say to listeners is, and to repeat your question if I may, that I did come out of business into politics for this particular issue, which I viewed to be the most important constitutional question the British had faced since the English Civil War back in the 17th century. And I'm not going to retire and live up on a mountain. When the moment's right to come back and influence this, I will do so.
All right. And it's impossible for us in America not to draw a correlation between your move out of business to politics for a specific reason with our own president, Donald Trump.
Mm.
He came from the business world into politics to get something done. And I think that you probably see that correlation and have heard that before, I'm sure.
Well, I do. And I mean, one of the things I like so much about your president is his absolute conviction. And there is a certain moral certainty about Trump. You know, the big tickets on which he was elected, he believes in today even more strongly than he did on November the 8th last year. The last time I spoke to him properly, you know, and obviously, I mean, I would never, go into private conversations. But let's just say that however much the judges, the media, Congress, or whoever it may be, however much they try to frustrate this man, however much they try and make him change course, he will not do so. He has the moral courage to believe in his convictions and to believe that he has a deal with the American voting public, and he's going to do his damnedest to honour that. And do you know something? I admire him hugely for it, because the easy thing to do is to give in, isn't it?
Oh, yes.
The easy thing is to give in, to bend, to suddenly find yourself very popular in Washington. But he's not like that. He isn't made like that. And that's why I am absolutely right behind him.
All right. And I want to go back and talk a little about the process from Brexit. So leaving the EU is it's a huge shift. I mean, it is a changing the future of a country, changing the future of the EU in a lot of ways too. So how does that conversation become a reality, a real possibility to get to that?
Well, I would say that actually leaving the EU as it's currently configured is the regaining of a country. I mean, you can't be a sovereign state if you can't make your own laws. You can't be a sovereign state if you can't control your own borders. I mean, these are the basic functions of a state. So hence, you know, my battle cry last year was, we want our country back, because I felt we'd literally given it away. It's never been done before. No one's ever left the EU. I mean, Greenland did 30 years ago, but it wasn't really the EU then. It was more of an economic club. No one knows. However, I think what the British government have to do is to not allow this bureaucracy to bully them, not allow themselves to be effectively publicly abused, because that's what we've been seeing over the course of the last few months. We have to be reasonable. We have to be fair-minded at all times, but equally, we have to be prepared in sort of General de Gaulle style, if it's not working, to pick up our briefcase and walk out of the room. And, you know, I was in business for a long time. And if you're in a business negotiation, and if it's in the interests of both sides for a deal to be concluded, the biggest fear your opponent has is that you will walk out of a door. Because then the deal's not concluded. And you may be a loser, but hey, he or she are going to be losers too. So we have to be resolute about this, but reasonable.
All right. And what does life after Brexit look? Let's say that things are completed in a way that are satisfactory, not in name only. You know, you get Britain regains itself. What is life after Brexit for you?
Well, there's a lot of talk about globalization in the modern, political and economic debate. I actually think that Brexit for the United Kingdom gives us an amazing opportunity in an ever rapidly globalizing world. It gives us the chance to reach out to make our own arrangements with different people. It gives us the chance to have a competitive advantage upon our next door neighbors in the same time zone. So I see Brexit as a massive potential land of opportunity for us. Now look, let's be honest. The key to Brexit is that we get to make the decisions. So we could make bad decisions. But if we make bad decisions, we could vote for somebody else to reverse what had been done by the previous government. For the last 30 plus years, we've been through this charade where at general elections, we don't talk about vast swathes of our economic life because it wouldn't matter whether the left, right, or the right won, because actually it was being decided somewhere else. So the key to it is we're back in charge. The opportunity is that we embrace the global economy and we reach out to a very big group of nations. And I would say that it's the United States of America and it's the Commonwealth. And what are the advantages? We speak the same language. We have similar, different, but similar legal systems. Culturally, there are little social differences, but basically, you know, kind of we enjoy the same sort of things. We're not very far apart. And actually, to put together close trade relationships where you've got that remarkable number of similarities to even start with, I think gives us an amazing opportunity. You know, Europe, I mean, look, I'm not anti-European, I never have been. I want us to be friendly with Europe. I love Europe for its richness of diversity, culture, language, cheese, wine, you name it. You know, you travel 100 miles across Europe and you find completely different peoples with different histories. It is the most extraordinary. It's a mosaic. Europe is this amazing mosaic. And I think that the approach since 1950 or so to try and meld all these different people into one actually is a mistake. What we should be championing is a Europe of individual sovereign nation states. And that may not be the most efficient thing, but you know what? We're people. We're not machines. We're human beings. And human beings have emotions and passions and beliefs and identities. And this attempt from upon high to think, oh, we can just get rid of Slovakia and we can abolish Britain and they'll all be European and we'll give them a new flag and a new anthem and they'll all be jolly happy. Do you know what? They won't. That theory has as much chance of working as communist Marxism did. You know, it may sound wonderful, it may sound like an idealized world, but it misunderstands human nature and it won't ever work.
Right, and that leads me right into another question I wanted to ask. In Britain, is there this resurgence of patriotism following Brexit, the vote even? Have you seen that?
No, I think it's the other way around. I think the Brexit vote actually was a direct result of the resurgence of patriotism. I think that we, particularly the English, I mean, oh, it's fine to say you're Scottish or Welsh or Northern Irish, or that's marvellous, you know, you fly your flag, but oh, please don't say you're English. Oh, no, it's racist to say you're English. And if you fly the English flag, I mean, this really is a dreadful insult to people who live here. I mean, it just, you can't believe how low we sunk on all of this. And I think because of all of that, and because of the absolute lack of courage of our leaders to ever stand up for any of the values that we've always been for, I think that phenomenon was happening anyway. People were saying, hey, do you know what? So when England play soccer, and this has now been going on for about 20 years, when England play soccer against, well, particularly Germany, but which is the real rivalry, you know. But when England play soccer, now you drive through cities and towns and people have got the cross of St. George draped out of their bedroom windows. You didn't see that 20 years ago, but you see that today. So there is a desire for identity. So I think actually Brexit was in a sense, not the cause of that, but in many ways the symptom of it.
Okay, because I mean, patriotism in America is huge, always
oh, yeah.
has been. There's
oh, yeah.
very proud patriotism
yeah.
across the entire nation. But it's interesting to see that sort of resurgence is what pushed Brexit in a lot of ways, when I would have thought it might have been the other way around. That's interesting.
No, I mean, look, obviously we're going through this very tricky moment right now with with this whole process. But obviously, I believe that not only will the benefits of Brexit be economic, not only will they be political, but perhaps there'll be something that you can't measure, that you can't write down on a piece of paper, that you can't quantify. Perhaps we'll feel more content about who we are, where our space in the world is, what our history means to us, what the aspirations are for the future. I think we'll be a lot more contented and a lot happier as a nation once this Brexit process is carried out.
All right, and I have a couple of things I want to get to left. What is the biggest difference you see between British politics and American politics?
God and guns. Quite simple. I mean, you know, there isn't much religion in British politics. One of the things that I'm fighting for is that I think we need to be a bit more muscular about the defense of our Judeo-Christian culture, but that's different to religion. Religion plays a much bigger part in American politics. Although it's very interesting that at the inauguration, you know, when Trump was sworn in, he put his hand on the prayer book that his mum had given him when he was nine. You know, and Trump, not considered to be one of the more religious leaders in America, and yet that, I thought, symbolically was very interesting. It said quite a lot. And of course, guns, where, you know, we have a very different attitude towards guns. I think you're too loose in one sense, and I think we're too tight in the other. The fact that we've banned the use of hand pistols completely, and the British Olympic team have to go to Calais to practice, suggests to me that maybe we've got this wrong. But equally, there are parts of America where you can go into a sort of Walmart and buy repeating rifles. So the gun, that is a big difference. Actually, and this will amaze your listeners, I think. So we have always prided ourselves on not having an armed police force. We've always believed that if you arm the police, then the professional burglar gang, knowing that the police were armed, would in turn arm, and you'd raise the levels and make things work. And do you know something? Actually, over the last 100 years, that's been quite successful. But we're now confronting a different problem. And when you see those three, well, let's use the Trump word, losers, shall we? When those three losers got out of that van in London Bridge to head into Borough Market to go on the stabbing spree, they were confronted by an armed London policeman who had a baton. And he tried to fight the three of them with a baton, and he was very bad. He survived, but he was very badly injured in his brave attempt to do that. Had he been carrying a firearm, there would have been no stabbings in Borough Market. They would have been dealt with there and then. As it was, it took another sort of 4 or 5 minutes for the armed response unit to get there. So I am actually now arguing that I think our police force should be routinely armed to deal with this new menace. So, but anyway, I've elaborated. They are two quite big fundamental differences.
Okay, and then the last question. If you could share a beer with any U.S. president, past, present, alive or dead, who would you choose?
Well, I have to say that I've got massive regard for Eisenhower. I mean, I think what a remarkable figure he was. And I suspect, actually, a rather better president, perhaps, than the history books give him credit for. But, oh, no, it's got to be Ronnie. It was that debate, wasn't it? It was. I think it was 84, would it have been, against Walter Mondale. And they were asked, you know, how do they feel of a morning, you know, about America? And Mondale said, oh, it's all terrible and it's awful and it's negative. And Ronnie just said, you know, I get up and the sun comes up and I just think, what a great, wonderful place this is. I mean, Ronnie just made people feel great about themselves. And he's the one person I really would have enjoyed sitting down and talking to him. Because, again, you see, really, if you think about it, he was the outsider, wasn't he? He was the B-movie actor. He was the guy that made his money advertising, I think it was Marlboro cigarettes or whatever, or Camel, or whatever it was. He was the guy without the classical education. He was the guy that was very non-Washington in so many ways, and yet he got through to become governor of California. I personally think a very great president, and I think he brought some amazing stability to this country.
All right, well, I hope you enjoyed a look back at CLC 2017. You can go and find out more about the upcoming CLC, which will be April 13th and 14th at the Crabtree Marriott in Raleigh, North Carolina. You can find out more about it at civitasclc.com. Again, that's civitasclc.com. Make sure you're subscribing to the show, following along on social media, using that user call-in line, and we'll catch you next time.